1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
Locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM. News, talk, and sports from Vesper to Plover.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Peter King in Orlando as Brittany Griner flies home after 10 months in a Russian prison. Phoenix fan Bhushan Kumar has some advice for the WNBA star.
She should come home, light up a joint because it's legal here, and don't go back to Russia.
Griner's wife, Sherelle, is conscious of the fact that while her partner is coming home, other Americans like Paul Whelan are still being held in Russia.
BG's not here to say this, but I will gladly speak on her behalf and say that BG and I will remain committed to the work of getting every American home, including Paul.
And some are questioning the release of the Russian prisoner exchanged for Griner. Here's CBS's Catherine Herridge.
What we've heard already from former U.S. government officials is some level of concern. They're questioning the wisdom of swapping a convicted arms dealer, Victor Boot, for a civilian. And Victor Boot was somebody who provided weapons to drug cartels, designated terrorist organizations, and to individuals who intended to harm American citizens. So they're questioning sort of the equivalency here.
The House has overwhelmingly passed a bill that protects same-sex and interracial marriage. CBS's Scott McFarland is on Capitol Hill.
Under this newly passed law, it guarantees the federal government must acknowledge a same-sex marriage if it's done legally in a state. So somebody who lives with a same-sex partner in a state where same-sex marriage is presumably outlawed could go across state lines, have it done legally elsewhere, and have that marriage recognized, no matter where they are in the country, by the federal government.
The president is expected to sign that bill into law soon. Los Angeles County is considering an indoor mask mandate this winter after the region entered the federal government's high COVID activity zone. County Health Director Dr. Barbara Ferrer is recommending masks for people two and up.
A high-quality, well-fitted mask that covers your nose and mouth can reduce the spread of COVID-19 when we most need to dampen spread.
And for now, this is a request and not a mandate. A historic day for money in the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has shown off a newly minted $5 bill signed by two female Treasury officials for the first time.
The first bank notes with my signature are being delivered this month to the Federal Reserve, and they'll be in circulation starting in the new year.
Yellen's signature appears with that of U.S. Treasurer Lynn Malerba, first Native American to hold that position. Big day on Wall Street with the Dow closing up 184 points. The NASDAQ gained 123. This is CBS News.
This hour's newscast is presented by Rocket Mortgage. Need to know what it takes for a home loan to fit your budget and your family? Rocket can.
Let's see, if something costs less, but people are happier with it, that sounds like something to look into, and that's MediShare. Maybe you've heard switching to MediShare to pay for healthcare can save the typical family $500 a month, and that's huge, but it's also true that people are way more satisfied after making the switch, too. The customer satisfaction rate for MediShare is double that of the typical health insurance plan. Double. MediShare works. It's been around for more than a quarter century, and members have shared more than $3 billion of each other's bills. People love having telehealth and a huge nationwide PPO network. So, yeah, you can save a ton and like it better. Imagine being happy with how you're taking care of your health care. So if you're self-employed or part of the gig economy, or you just want a plan you're happy with, you can call right now and get a price within 2 minutes. A very, very smart use of 2 minutes. Here's the number you need. 866-88-BIBLE. That's 866-88-BIBLE. 866-88-BIBLE.
No one ever made a highlight from the sidelines. Get in the game, join the conversation with WFHR's Playmakers. Call in Monday mornings from 10.06 to 11 with your sports thoughts. And Tuesday through Friday, listen in while we talk with some of the most insightful, intriguing people in Morning Magazine. Talk radio that speaks to you. Get in the game, join the conversation at 10.06 Mondays with Playmakers. And Tuesday through Friday, Morning Magazine on WFHR, locally grown radio.
The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Cynthia and Ed. My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, out of the blue, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. And she didn't know whether she should go forward or turn or just stay at the stop sign. She wasn't even really sure where she was at. She was very concerned. It was very unsettling for her.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it, to bring the family in on it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, I don't want you to worry or be afraid. I'll be there for you and we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Overcast skies tonight with lows around 22. East winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Cloudy skies again tomorrow, snow likely, highs around 33. Overcast tomorrow night, chance of snow, lows dip down to about 26. 1 to 2 inches of snow tomorrow through Saturday night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 27.
Your hometown station for news, talk, and sports. Locally grown radio is 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Thank goodness Tuesday is over. I'm sure the good folks in Georgia are as happy as all of us. And that a sane, rational senator will be seated in the Senate from Georgia. And I got to tell you, I'm just shocked and amazed at where we are. Today, very special program. I've made it over to Birmingham, Alabama from Atlanta. One of my favorite places for ribs. Yes, one of my favorite food places on the planet. And I'm sitting here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones, who's been gracious enough to bring us in and share some thoughts on the election on Tuesday. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Look, I'm so glad you came over, Rick. I always appreciate you making time. And it's always great to share a plate of barbecue with anybody from out of town that appreciates good barbecue.
No, it was fabulous today. And thank you for that. But you know, let's talk about what happened Tuesday, because I'm still shocked and amazed that Herschel Walker came anywhere close. I had said I thought it was going to be a 3 to 5% race if folks were allowed to vote, 5 to 7. It was 3%, but it should not have been that close.
No, there's no question. It should not have been that close. But, it was the same way it played out over all of the contested races in across the country, where there were kind of swing state districts, swing state states. The tribalism in this country is so strong that it is going to make these races continue to be close. Continue to be competitive, which is a good news, bad news thing. The good news is you want to love competitive races where people are competing. The bad news is that it is so tribal now, where people are putting on the jerseys, their red jersey or blue jersey, that races like this, when you have as flawed a candidate as you had in Herschel Walker, can maintain and actually get this close when it should never have been close. Everybody, I think, fully appreciates the fact that Georgia deserved better than a Herschel Walker. Warnock said it over and over, and I think the people of Georgia ultimately got it. But it was damn close, because right now people are conditioned to vote for their team and not for the person, or what the person stands for, because no one could know what Herschel Walker stood for.
That's the thing. As we were on the ground talking to people, no one had any idea of what he was talking about. All they said was, and I'll never forget this, and this was multiple times, that he's an imperfect vessel, and that he's a good one. He's a good one. He will do what he's told. And there's a lot to unpack in that. But the first time I heard it, I go, well, that's odd. But I heard it several times over my course of the 10 days I was there in Atlanta. And that's scary.
And they say that there is no racism in America anymore. He's a good one. Oh, come on. He'll do what he's told. I mean, we're
isn't that what the messaging was? Oh, because no, they had him between Lindsey Graham and
that has been part of the, you know, the whole thing with the Southern strategy is to divide people, to do things. And Herschel Walker was acceptable as a good one because he got anointed, but he was going to do as he was told. I mean, think about that. That's coming from the deep South. That is just horrific in this day and age, but it is absolutely true. And you go into other places and it doesn't have to be the race thing, but you would have seen that with Dr. Oz. You would have seen it with others that will do what they're told. They don't want free thinkers sometime. And especially in red states in the South, people have grown up and have been conditioned to vote a certain way. And it takes a lot to get them to move off of it. Fortunately, in Georgia, there were just enough people to move off of that and just enough independents that recognized the differences in these candidates that truly was able to put the victory in Warnock's column.
Yeah, no, I've been saying for a long time, you know, we've been hit with this red hat, blue hat thing, and I keep coming back to, it's not about the red hats or the blue hats, it's got to be about the hard hats.
Absolutely.
And moving us forward and rebuilding this country and to do the things that the working class of this country needs, because as long as we stay red hat, blue hat, we're never going to get the things that we need: education, healthcare, infrastructure, jobs, any of those things. We're going to continue just to fight amongst each other for the crumbs that are left.
There's no question about it, and we've gotten to the point in this country that so many people are seeing their teams not in a competition with the other, but it's literally good versus evil. It is one of those things where people are stoking violence. People, you look at what happened January 6th, people legitimately thought, and I say legitimately, they believed, whether, you know, you can't really say legitimately believed because the whole premise was not legitimate. But the fact is, so many people believe the election was stolen, and they would resort to violence to that. Right now, there are people across this country who truly believe that every Democrat is evil, regardless of which side of the tent, the big tent that Democrats are, they think that you're evil. Likewise, there are folks in the Democratic Party that think everybody, not just these MAGA extremist, clearly Oath Keeper type racist folks are evil, but that the average Republican voter is evil. And we got to get away from that. We got to start building a middle here. We got to start building the center a little bit stronger so that we can compete for those voices, so we can compete for ideas, because that's how you get this country moving forward.
No, you're absolutely right. Because look, I remember a period where I had Republican friends who were staunch conservatives, and we would have conversations, we would argue, we would go back and forth. And at the end of the day, we'd walk away from each other, not wanting harm or ill to fall upon the other. And yet all of those friends that I've had have fallen off by the wayside because now we have to be enemies. And this is, it's not healthy for democracy to have this be the scenario we're in. I want to fight over ideas. I want to argue about the best way to make lives better and to help people without having to demonize.
No, and because here's the problem. You're not supposed to make a bargain with the devil. If you think the other side is the devil and a demon, you're not going to want to try to have a dialogue with them and find a common ground. You're going to assume that there is no common ground. And that's where I think the problem on both the right and the left are right now. If you assume that the other side is in a place to where you cannot find common ground because they're demons, they're evil, then you're not even going to look for it. And I think we've got to move back from that. Yeah. You know, think about the foreign policy. I was tweeted something yesterday about the fact that Biden, the number of ambassadors for Biden that are vacant right now because he can't get them through the Senate is extraordinary. At a time when, you know, tensions across the globe are rising, and it's not just the Middle East anymore. It's in Europe with Russia. It's in with China. And our foreign policy, it used to be said that partisanship stopped at the water's edge.
Right.
No longer. You've got Republicans holding these nominees up. You've got them trying to inject their own views. And it's just sometimes just one or two senators. We've got to figure this out. I mean, we've got to figure out a way that we can find that common ground without demonizing the other.
But what do you say to my Republican friends who would go, but, you know, the Democrats did this first. When you guys were in the Senate, you blocked Trump's nominees.
No, that's not true. The fact of the matter is, when I was in the Senate, Mitch McConnell controlled the floor. And the fact is, we put through, and Donald Trump put through, what, a third of the judiciary right now, or 25%, something like that. There were a ton of those nominees that went through there. But the one thing that you're talking about, and I want to make a clear distinction, by the way, between a lifetime appointment in the judiciary with an ambassador that's going to come and go with this administration. I think there's a huge difference with that. I've always believed that a president, even a Donald Trump in the day, should have his team in place.
Right.
And give the president, he was elected by the people of this country, and put that team in place. So the needle kind of moves toward a presumption of doing that. There is a difference when you're talking about a lifetime appointment that is going to be there long after that president leaves. So you did not see as many of the nominees blocked. You know, there is no filibuster, by the way, Rick, in the Senate for nominees for either judiciary or the administration. But senators can still make blocks. And were there some blocked? Absolutely. There's always those games that are played. But by and large, I think nominations move through the Senate when I was there in the 3 years that I was there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, reflexively, what people do is they're going to, well, you did it first. And this is the kind of stuff that has to at some point stop, because we're coming towards a Republican-led House very soon. And,
yes.
And I think everyone is anticipating whoever the speaker is going to be. It doesn't look like McCarthy's going to have the votes. Maybe he will. But it looks like the crazy wing, they're going to want an impeachment for who knows what reason. I'm sure they'll find something. But they want their pound of flesh back, it seems.
Yeah, there's no question. And there's got to be in the Senate, in the House, enough political courage to say no. Yes, the other side did X, whatever that X might be. But we need to be better than that. We need to get back. And I think if that can start, it would snowball. It would carry over. But there was that. And look, I'm going to be honest. In the Democratic caucus when I was there, I heard it a lot, especially in that last year. We don't want to do X. We don't want to give Donald Trump a win. Well, that's, you know, I never agreed with it. I spoke up against it because I said, look, this is not about Donald Trump. This is a piece of legislation that ought to pass. We ought to be able to work with and claim credit for it yourself a little bit, but it's going to be good for America. But there are those folks on both sides of the aisle that, you know, the filibuster is a good example. You know, the minute Mitch McConnell takes the gavel again, he's going to get rid of the filibuster. So we may as well do it now to push through our
agenda. You're in favor of eliminating the filibuster?
No, I'm not. I have never been in favor of completely eliminating. I do think there are serious rule changes that need to be made in the U.S. Senate to get the filibuster back into an area when it was where it was supposed to be, and you just can't phone in an objection. And you've got to hold the floor. You've got to do these things and give people time to work through some things. I think there is a space for the filibuster because the Senate was designed to give the minority a voice, but it was never designed to let the minority completely block legislation that a majority of the United States Senate and a majority of the public are pushing through. But there does need to be some changes. And when those changes, if they ever come, you know, they're going to bite Democrats on occasion. Yeah. There will be a time when there is a Republican Senate and a Republican House and a Republican president. And it will bite the Democrats. But that's the way America works. That's the way democracy works. It's not always pretty.
Yeah.
But it
we're
is,
seeing that.
It's still the greatest system that's been devised yet. And if we can just, as Ben Franklin said, we've got a republic if we can just hold on to it.
Yeah, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Doug Jones, former Alabama senator. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickssmithshow.com here in Birmingham, Alabama. You know, you bring up the idea of the filibuster, and I've said from the beginning, I want to go back to the, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington days where you've got to hold the floor. A talking filibuster is what, if it's so important that something stops, everything should stop, in my view.
Absolutely.
But, you know, nobody really wants to do that. I mean, we're not that kind of a society, I don't think. Do you see us moving back to that potentially?
You know, I don't know. Here's an issue.
Because my fear is, and I agree with you, my fear is that you do away with it entirely, and now we end up having these wild pendulum swings.
Absolutely.
And we become a banana republic of, once Social Security is destroyed, you don't immediately rebuild it.
Right.
Once you make these really big draconian kind of cuts to social programs, it's hard to rebuild that. So I do have some fear. While I do advocate for doing away with it, I do have some fear.
No, there's no question. And here's an interesting thing that people don't fully appreciate about the Senate rules right now. You go back to Mr. Smith goes to Washington and holding that floor, just that alone. Any senator right now can hold that floor for as long as they want to. You're normally given X amount of time. But if you want to sit there and read green eggs and ham and hold that floor forever, you can. But you got to hold the floor. And you can still do that. You can still quote
filibuster. Watched all of Bernie's.
Yeah. You can hold it. But at the moment you take a break, you relinquish that floor, and that's when things move. There's got to be a procedure in place where people can't just phone in an objection. You got to make relevant arguments on the debate, and you have a series of votes. And it gives people time, Rick. A filibuster is designed to give people time. That if you could literally shut down the Senate during this filibuster, okay, during the debate, and there's no other votes that can be taken on the floor. You can't do unanimous consent votes. You can't do anything. It shuts down the Senate. At some point, both sides are going to say, we got to figure out how to do this. We either got to come to an agreement or somebody has got to abandon this. And when those filibusters happened, and the rare occasion in the 60s, 70s, when the filibusters took place, you would have senators caucusing in the majority or minority leader's office or in the cloakrooms, trying to figure out the way, how can we break this? People often forget that the filibuster was rarely used until more modern history. And by that, I mean in the last 20 or 30 years. It was just rarely used because folks could get together. We really need to get back. That's the deliberative body that the United States Senate should be. Not just where folks, that the only thing you see on C-SPAN is political speeches on the floor. They can give their damn speeches anywhere they want to. But on the Senate floor, it needs to be substantive speeches about the issue at hand that they are voting on.
No, the reason I want to go back to a talking filibuster is just what you said. I want you to tell me why you're against X, Y, or Z. Why can't we provide sick days to all workers? Why can't we help, you know, single mothers who need food and health care and things for children? Tell me why. Just don't read the phone book. I think you should have to stay on task. But you brought up C-SPAN, and I've often questioned whether that was the beginning of the downfall of that working together, because now the average citizen sees the sausage making. They see these senators who have now become media stars. I look in the House, we've got a number of people. I don't believe they're working on any substantive legislation to help me or anybody else, but they are working on their rising media star.
Yeah, you're not seeing the sausage being made on C-SPAN unless you start listening to committee hearings and going behind the scenes and listening to the staff talking, which you'll never get. You don't see it by watching the House floor or the Senate floor. You see political speeches. It may be about the issue that they're debating, but the odds are it is not going to be. They're going to be bashing the other side. It's going to be a purely political speech, or as you said, it's going to be a self-aggrandizing speech to up their political game. I think it would be easy to say to put the blame on television in the House and the Senate, but I think it's really more per people. Yeah. I think it really should come down to people having the political will and the political courage to not just make those speeches, but have the kind of colloquy that you're talking about. You're not talking about just asking the questions or making the speech. What you're talking about is a back and forth between senators. You know, tell me why you don't like paid family leave and let them answer on the floor of the Senate. And then ask more questions. I mean, it's that kind of give and take that you miss so much In the U.S. Senate these days.
Yeah, I mean, it just looks like everything has become political grandstanding just to raise money and to get votes and more raising money.
Yeah.
You know, so this is where I look at this and I go, you know, Citizens United did, I believe, irreparable harm. And now money is speech and wealthy people have much more speech than an average everyday working stiff like me or you. And you know, something has to be done on this frame because the money is getting out of hand.
Oh, my God. The money that was spent this election cycle, the money that's going to be spent the next election cycle is stunning. And it is not, by the way, the money that the candidates are raising. Remember, a candidate, Herschel Walker, a Raphael Warnock, name the candidate themselves. They can only raise this like $2,900 an election per person. Okay? That's all.
Right.
PACs can give $5,000 per election, which means like in Georgia, they could have given $5,000 to Warnock and Walker during the primary, another $5,000 for the general election, and another $5,000 for the runoff. So these PACs and all of this corporate money that go to candidates, you know, it's pretty limited. They don't have that control. It's the independent expenditures. It's the super PACs. It's the C4 organizations, which don't even have to report their donors. That's where this money is coming in. That's where all the money was spent. Democrats this year, as candidates, outraised their Republican counterparts across the country by whopping amounts. But it was the individual PACs and C4s and independent expenditures where the big money, the $10, $12, $15, $20 million donors are putting in money. And you can rattle off all the names. We don't have to. You can rattle off all the names. That's where the money is. It's the independent expenditures. If we could somehow limit that and keep it within the campaigns and let the campaigns only run the show, wow, what a difference it would make.
Yeah, because you look at these TV ads. I mean, oh my gosh, who's got the money? Comcast has got to be thrilled because they're making tons of money. But I don't even know that half of the ads are anywhere near accurate.
No. Well, they don't have to be accurate anymore. There's no reason for them to have to be accurate. They're not going to be challenged. And what you see, if people think about these ads, you know, under a campaign, if you're an ad that is running on behalf of a campaign, like my TV ads that I ran, at the end of every one of them, I had to say, I'm Doug Jones and I approve this message for the very reason that you're talking about, that to give some honesty that the candidate knows what the hell is being said in that TV ad. These super PAC ads, these C4 ads, you don't hear that. You don't see that. And that's where most of the money was spent.
Yeah.
It's in those ads where you don't know who the hell the donors are. And that's a problem, too. The secretive dark money in this country is stunning. And I think people, if they really drilled down on it, I think they would be appalled and I think they would do something about it. Unfortunately, most people are really busy dealing with their lives than to have to rise up on campaign finance.
And do you have hope? I mean, going forward, I mean, the way things are, it looks like we're rocketing in different directions.
No.
And you know, there's a moment where I've had people just, I just want it to stop.
Yeah.
You know, and I go back to 2011 in Wisconsin, 11 and 12, and, you know, the voters there were just, please let it stop. The folks here in Georgia, this is the second, you know, Senate race that's had a runoff, and all of the attention and the phone calls and the door knocking and all the stuff that groups are doing to get out the vote. People are just like, can we just stop?
Right.
You know, and it's turning, I fear that it's turning people away.
Well, it may be. I don't know. There is something to be said, though, Rick, the fact that we have seen a rise in the number of people voting.
Yeah.
I mean, look at this. I mean, look what happened. That was a rise. So, you know, where I have hope is that I saw in this election cycle a rise in the younger voters of this country getting out to vote. That's what gives me hope.
I'm right there with you. Can you stick around through the break?
Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break right here. On the other side, we're going to come back, talk with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Want to get some of it?
Pride.
Left corner, three on the way. Got it. excellence.
Yes, it counts, and a foul.
Commitment.
Drops the hammer. Thank you and good night.
For Badgers, they're not just words. They're words to live by.
It's over. Let's have a party, Badger Nation.
This is your radio home for the Badgers.
Catch all the Badgers men's basketball action in the Big Ten this year right here on WFHR, locally grown radio, your home for Wisconsin sports.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Sweetie, want some fruit?
You have to use the right tool for the job. A power drill is the wrong tool to slice fruit. Just like an antibiotic is the wrong tool to treat viruses, including colds and flu. Antibiotics are only needed for certain bacterial infections. When they aren't needed, antibiotics won't help you, and the side effects could still hurt you. Ask your healthcare professional when an antibiotic is the right tool and when it's not. Visit cdc.gov/antibiotic-use.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in a thousand pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
I'm looking at the phone lines. I'm seeing some familiar faces. Once in a minute, Gene of Eau Claire.
Well, welcome back, Matt. I really miss you. We've been missing getting woke every morning, but now we'll get woke in the afternoon.
Once in a minute, Andrew of Detroit.
Professor, it's so nice you're back. We missed you during your vacation, and I'm very happy to be in your class for the semester.
Thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate all my callers.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
Victor deployed for the first time to Afghanistan in 2003. At 4 in the morning, my phone rang. They said, I regret to inform you that your husband was wounded in action. Victor sustained a moderate traumatic brain injury. I was doing school full time, and I was also then caring for Victor. One of the most important elements of caregiving is taking care of yourself. I just didn't want to forget that I also had goals and that I also had a life. What I did is I challenged Victor to meet me halfway. There are almost 6 million military and veteran caregivers across the nation. We have our own journey, and we can fulfill that journey at the same time that we are helping our loved one.
Visit aarp.org/caregiving for a free military veteran's guide to navigate your caregiving journey and better care for your loved one and yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Overcast skies tonight with lows around 22. East winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Cloudy skies again tomorrow, snow likely, highs around 33. Overcast tomorrow night, chance of snow, lows dip down to about 26. 1 to 2 inches of snow tomorrow through Saturday night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 27.
From Lake Wazeecha and beyond, your news, talk, and sports is locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
Members frustrated with the proposed closing of the UW Richland campus. Supporters say some of the reasons for declining enrollment are due to the UW system's lack of financial support, drastic reductions in faculty and staff, and no marketing or strategic plans. They'll forward a petition to Governor Evers, UW System President Jay Rothman, and area lawmakers. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM.
This is Jim Hightower saying, if billionaire humanoids like Elon really wanted to save us from extinction, they would do the honorable thing by going first.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So today I stopped in Birmingham, downtown Birmingham, went over by the Civil Rights Center that was, I've talked about many times here. I was in Kelly Ingram Park and took the tour, grabbed a couple of I'll call them local tour guides. Generally when someone walks up to me and asks for a dollar, I say, I'll give you a dollar, but you give me the tour, I'll give you 20. Well, both gentlemen gave me the tour and very, very good information. But both of them, when they asked, hey, why are you here? I said, well, I'm here to interview former Senator Doug Jones. And they all looked at me with big eyes, big smiles, and said, he's a bad man. And here to share some thoughts on being that.
But bad in a good way, right?
No, they were effusive with praise, Doug, because, you know, again, the look in their eyes, the look on their faces, they knew you're a champion. And then they went into the whole fact that you're the guy who went and prosecuted the people who are responsible for killing those four little girls in the 16th Street Baptist Church bomb.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of folks. I still get far too much credit for all of that. We were successful, and I'm very, very proud of it. So I'm glad some people that are roaming through the park still recognize it.
No, but, you know, the reality is, and this is where, you know, in my mind, I listened to the stories of these two gentlemen who were, you know, young children at the time, talking about their experience, you know, growing up in this environment. And I couldn't help but think about the bravery of those kids who came out of that church for the Children's March. And look, I can't imagine the bravery, you know, of you and your staff and the people who actually finally sought justice in this, something that could have been easily let go.
Well, it could have been let go, Rick, but at the same time, I think for those of us who even looked at that case, you just couldn't let it go. I mean, there was something deep down that you just could not let go. You knew that justice had not been served. It had been served only partially with a 1977 conviction. And none of us that worked on that case, and we did it for, you know, I became U.S. attorney in 97. I left right after the first of those bombings in 01, so it took 3 or 4 years. None of us ever considered what we were doing to be brave. We really believed in what we were doing. We felt and knew that it was the right thing to do. We also knew that, you know, that in a time and a place earlier in Birmingham's history, that the investigation was actually thoroughly investigated by the FBI. It's kind of a legend that it was not, that Hoover didn't really want to solve it. Not true. He actually did want to solve it because he felt that the Bureau's reputation was at stake.
Right.
Okay. So he put a lot of resources, but there was the myth that he never did. And so part of this was also to make sure that the people of this city, the people in that community, felt like that somebody had come in there and looked and cared enough to reopen it, take the chances on it. And we were very fortunate. We were fortunate with our evidence. We were fortunate enough with people that had lived long enough to testify. And we were fortunate enough that a jury in Alabama finally would give the prosecution and the defense a fair shake. And that's all you're supposed to ask for in a court of law.
Yeah, and, you know, the first time we came down here was 2015. We did a civil rights tour because, you know, you know how those things go. Your kids come home from school. What'd you learn today? Kind of thing. And my oldest daughter came home and said, you know, she learned about Rosa Parks. And I quizzed her, you know, what did you learn? And it was just, she was tired. And I go, well, there's a lot more to that. So, you know, me doing this and wanting my kids to learn a little bit more, we decided, hey, let's go to these places and let's talk to people and learn the actual history. And the reason I bring this up is, you know, we're battling over this theory about race that's critical and this argument right. that we're seeing in school boards and all this. I want people to know what really happened so that it never happens again.
Yeah, yeah.
That, to me, that's the part, that's the reason you learn history.
Well, there's no question about that. And I just finished reading John Meacham's new book about Lincoln. It's remarkable. And the way he documented everything that he put in there about the South and about slavery and about how the South still, after the end of the war, wanted to promulgate this myth of the lost cause, which we are still dealing with today. We are absolutely still dealing with here today. But it is exactly the reason we have to learn this history accurately, factually. You cannot put a gloss over some of the things that we've done in this country. But the fact is, you learn from those things. It's like human thing. You have learned from your mistakes in life. At least I hope you have. I know I have learned from most of them anyway. We still, yeah, I get it. But the fact is, that's how you do learn and grow.
The big ones anyway.
The big ones, absolutely. There's no question. And so, that's why I just get so dismayed listening to these people talking about that we really need to kind of gloss over this whole slavery issue and as if there is not still vestiges of that systemic racism that exists today. It does. And we need to face that. And when we can face it and talk about it, we can deal with it. But if you don't face it and you don't want to talk about it, you don't want to learn about it, it's hard to deal with.
Yeah. Now, I had always said, growing up in Cleveland is a very segregated city. I grew up in a minority community. I was the white kid in the black neighborhood.
Right.
We played this neat game called Jace the White Kid and Beat Him Up, which wasn't a fun game. But early on, I learned that the only color that really mattered was green, because at the end of the month, growing up in the projects, we were all broke. So for a long time, I thought that was the frame of mind. It wasn't really until that tour that I did in 2015, because I thought I had a handle on it, where you went into a lot of these places where we treated black people really, really badly. And now there's a tourist trap there to bring people in. I hope it's to educate, but there's a lot of tourism around how bad we were to people. And there's so many opportunities to educate. But even then, for me, it wasn't until you see these images and you see the history and you... I'll give you one moment. It was at the Civil Rights Center here. And there's a little case with the four girls' belongings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an emotional person. I get choked up about nothing. I don't cry at movies. But a tear came to my eye looking into that box where there was a little clutch purse of one of the little girls who...
Denise.
Who had, things that my kids who were that age would have in their purses. And it was that moment that it became real.
It became personal. I mean, we had, and I tell this story a lot, there were two things in the bombing trials that we did that really brought home, I think, the horror of those murders. One was Denise McNair's shoes that we introduced into evidence.
Yeah.
The other, Rick, was a piece of mortar that was embedded in Denise McNair's skull as a result of that bombing that her father had gotten from the mortician, and then he kept it and he displayed it at his photography studio, Chris McNair. And I asked him one time, because we had been friends for a long time, I said, "Why do you display this, Chris? It seems a little bit over the top." And he said, "Doug, people mourn. They come and they mourn for the kids, and they're sad about what happened. But until they see the mortar that was embedded in Denise's skull, they really can't appreciate what people can do in the name of hate."
Yeah.
And so I wanted that jury to not only see that piece of mortar, but to feel it. And the shoes, because it brings it all home. I'll never forget in the closing argument of the first trial, the defense lawyer accused me of injecting sympathy into the trials. And my retort was, "I didn't murder those kids. This guy murdered those kids. If there is any sympathy being injected for the families, it's because of the actions of this man right here."
Yeah.
I think when people come to Birmingham, people go to Montgomery for the the Equal Justice Initiative lynching memorial. That's an incredibly powerful and moving, and you cannot help from walk away from there with a different feeling about this country, about where it is. But it's not a bad feeling. And that's what I want people to realize, that when you learn about this, you're like, how could some of this happen? But you don't come away with it ashamed. You come away with it with a resolve to make sure we continue to do better, to make this more a more perfect union. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, I mean, I when we were here in 2015, we did a number of interviews with people who were the children who were in the march. And,
right.
You know, I think about the bravery that must have taken, you know, 50 at a time to be leaving that church, to walk out to the dogs, the tanks, the water cannons, all of that. But there was one guy who stuck out in my mind, and his name was Fate Morris. And the story that he told, I had no idea who he was.
Right.
And we're sitting out, we're talking, and all of a sudden he's telling me this story. And this old broken down man just starts sobbing as if the memory of finding his sister was yesterday.
Right. Absolutely. Cynthia Morris Wesley, who has been living with the Wesley family at the time of her death. Fate was just, the families of these victims were just absolutely incredible to deal with. They really were. They were, but it was all still very real. I go back to some of the things I was saying in the trial, that a mother's heart never stops weeping for the loss of a child. And we had two mamas that testified in those trials in 2001 and 2002. And it was an emotional time.
So, you know, the reason I bring this up is because we're in a moment in this country where we're arguing about history. We're arguing about that happening. We're arguing about, you know, did other parts of history happen, and in the worst ways. I mean, we've got Holocaust deniers. We've got right-wing extremists. And again, we're this divergence away from the middle of the road and common ground seems to be accelerating. And I'm not sure how we stop that.
Yeah, no, look, it is not just about race anymore. It's race, it's religion. It's not just about black and white anymore. You just have seen in the last few years, you saw what happened in Charleston, South Carolina. You saw what happened in Charlottesville. You saw what happened in Buffalo, New York. You see what happened in Uvalde, Texas. You see where things go and people are going crazy. And there is this sense that the political rhetoric is stoking some of this violence, because it's really hard for people to understand that when you start talking a certain way, there are people out there that have triggers, and those triggers, it doesn't take much to set them off, and it leads to violence. People have to be a lot more careful,
right,
with what they're saying and what they're doing, because today's political world is much more than just black and white. It is much, much more than that. It includes the gay community, includes religion and the Muslim community. It includes Hispanics. It includes the Chinese. Think about all of the hate crimes that the Chinese have endured based on a lot of Donald Trump's rhetoric. And of course, you've still got the rise of the anti-Semitic violence that has been occurring in this country the last 4 or 5 years. We got to figure this out. We got to figure this out without tearing each other apart.
So is this a political problem? You know, because I thought I kind of had a handle on the rise of Trumpism. You know, I talk about my family, who basically are the basket of deplorables. They've always been somewhat racist, somewhat homophobic, somewhat misogynistic. It's the era in which they grew up. And I'm not justifying it.
Sure.
But that never motivated them to vote before. What motivated them to vote was Trump told them, conned them into believing that he was going to recreate Brook Park Avenue. He was going to bring back all those union jobs, all that manufacturing, all the things that gave them hope and opportunity for the present and the future. You know, the wages, the hours, the conditions, the health care, all that stuff. They thought that was coming back. It wasn't the race. It wasn't right. The misogyny. But we seem to be picking up on the other side of it. You know, while desperation, and I've heard it said a number of times that you give me somebody who's a little bit desperate, a little bit afraid, a little bit, fearful. You give me enough time and I'll give you a jihadist or a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that where we are?
No. Look, and again, there's a lot to unpack, as you said earlier. I agree. I completely understand. I saw the same thing here in Alabama and other places where people thought that Donald Trump was going to bring back all. He was going to make America great again, despite the fact that I don't know what the hell that meant. Did they think it was going to be okay to make it the way it was in the 50s with segregated lunch counters? I don't know. But they really believed it was going to happen. And when it did not happen, and it did not happen under Donald Trump for those folks. It only happened for Wall Streeters and the most in corporate America and the richest in America. It did not help the folks in Alabama. It did not help your family probably. But they blamed somebody else.
Right.
And it was easy to blame Democrats and socialists, which were just completely the opposite. I mean, it was just farcical. But there was they didn't want to blame Donald Trump for not delivering. They blamed Democrats and others for stopping him from succeeding, which was just unbelievable to me that people would still buy into his just total BS.
Yeah.
But they are.
They believed that there was a plan. There was a master plan.
There was a plan. There was a plan. And if we were just successful, he would follow through with it. With Donald Trump's master plan has always been about Donald Trump.
No, excellent point. But, you know, we're in this moment. And again, and I keep coming back to where we are, where we seem to be normalizing the kind of hatred and the kind of you know, things that... You know, I remember learning about the Holocaust, and I remember learning about that era and going, you know, how could they be so stupid? You know, how could they fall for that kind of rhetoric? But I fear here we are.
Oh, yeah. No, look, it was just the basic not standing up and speaking out. That's the fear that I have. That's why I've been critical of Republican leaders who have been so reluctant to challenge not racism, because they all challenge racism and say that there's no place. They all challenge bigotry and say there's no place in America for that, or in the Republican Party. They all challenge violence. No, they challenge it, but then they are silent when they're talking about the individuals who are stoking that. They need to be saying there is no longer any place in American politics for Donald Trump. Not with what he is doing when he is having candlelight dinners with avowed racist and anti-Semites, when he is talking about literally tearing up the Constitution of the United States simply because he didn't win an election. There is some serious, serious stuff going on there that needs to be repudiated, more than just simply some generic, a person that says that will never get elected. Well, they're going to get elected unless you, Mitch McConnell, unless you Republican leaders stand up and speak out against not what's being said, against the individual that's saying it, and take the chance. We've got to have, you go back, Rick, to what we do. We are in this moment. I agree with you. But it does need to take a little political courage on both sides of the aisle to stand up and speak out and to push back hard when we see things like that, to push back, not just on the rhetoric, but push back on the individuals given the rhetoric and let the political chips fall where they're going to fall.
Yeah.
And right now there's too many people that are too worried about protecting their political backsides than they are about protecting the country.
Does it start with having to hold Donald Trump accountable? I mean, I know a lot of people are talking about the January 6th committee. Now they've said they're going to make criminal referrals. I look at the story today. Evidently, there's a storage locker somewhere that's got more documents in it. I wonder what, you know, Trump left in the White House. And I got to wonder what more is there. He had classified documents. Is it this sense that nobody's accountable anymore? I mean, because, you know, if it were me, they'd be locking me up by now.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. But now, look, in DOJ's defense and some other things, this is a unique situation where you've got to make sure you get it right. You cannot just barrel into this thing because you know you're going to be accused of politics. So I do think that there is some accountability that has to be had. What form that takes, though, I think remains to be seen. And I'm going to let Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice do their job. I've got a lot of confidence in them, and I've got a lot of confidence in the way this is being handled right now.
So you as a former prosecutor, I want to make sure I get this straight, because a lot of us, me included, are going, come on, let's move this along.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I get it. Look, I totally get it. But here's the reason that you're feeling that because a separate branch of government, the legislative branch, had hearings, conducted their own investigation, a lot of public evidence out that cannot be used in a trial in a court of law.
Right.
Completely different track. And so they took depositions. DOJ can't take depositions. They've only got to bring them in front of a grand jury unless they just want to give them a statement. There is so different, Rick, that the great thing about the January 6th committee is that they have been incredibly deliberate. They've been incredibly efficient. They have moved with much more speed than I thought they could do with an incredible amount of evidence that they had to work with. But that the downside is it creates in the public's mind why hasn't DOJ gone ahead? If the January 6th committee could do this, why can't DOJ? And it is a completely different branch of government with completely different sets of rules, and you've got to make sure you get it right. Because at the end of the day, you're not playing for public opinion. You're not playing for history. You've got to convince 12 men and women on a jury unanimously that someone is guilty of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a pretty heavy burden. So the burden on the DOJ is just unbelievable right now.
And listen to the Rick Smith Show here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. You know, Doug, I'm looking at this, and again, I want to kind of wrap this around the idea that, you know, maybe there's a way forward. You know, again, we're in these polar opposite sides. We've got our teams. How do we move this forward? I mean, you know, it's going to be in 2 years of insanity in the House, I fear. I just see us getting worse and worse. Where do you see things? How would you move things
look,
forward?
Look, I think you move things forward by continuing to try to have the dialogues. You continue to try to reach out across and find common ground. You cannot govern with my way or the highway. That's the success that the last 2 years have been is because there have been compromises in legislation that has done great things that have not been done before. You've got to continue on that path. If the House wants to spend all their time looking into somebody's laptop, fine. But you need to push back on that with facts. You can't let the distortion of those facts overshadow the good things that is going on with the administration, the good things that are going to be going on with the Senate. But at the same time, there's just got to be people on both sides of the aisle that will sit down in a common purpose. And Rick, there are a lot more that goes on than people see. That's the thing we were talking about C-SPAN and everything else, that they only see the vitriol, they only see the political speeches. They don't see what's going on between the senators and their staffs behind the scenes trying to find that common ground. They just need to talk about it more, and we need to dial back the rhetoric a little bit more about where we are in this country. That will help, because if folks in Washington, D.C. will do that, it will filter down to the public, because it's the public is a reflection of what they see going on, not what's actually going on up there. That's the crazy thing about this. So you
actually saw this kind of walking.
Absolutely.
Because we're led to believe that, you know, you watch the F channel, you watch some of the media, you know, everyone's, you know, yelling at each other. It doesn't look like there's any.
Oh, no, there are things. There were, you know, look, I had bipartisan bills, 20-something bipartisan bills that signed into law in only 3 years. And it was because I could sit down and my staff could sit down with Tom Cotton, who I disagree with on so many issues, but we found some common ground on some issues in the banking committee. Ted Cruz and I found something on the Cold Civil Rights Case Act. We were able to do that in different ways. So there is a lot of that going on. The rules of the Senate somehow prohibit that. And the thing that I criticize a little bit is that senators often will sign up on bills and it'll be a bipartisan bill, and they think they've done their job to be bipartisan. But that's really only part of the story. They need to publicly get there with those folks and together tout them. We saw that happen in the infrastructure bill, unfortunately, and we saw it happen with the CHIPS Act. We saw it happen with the PAC Act for veterans. We need to see it more. Yeah. We'll see it with the NDAA to some extent, the National Defense Authorization. We'll see it with some appropriations if they can ever get there. But they need to have more pieces of legislation that they can sit there and not just work behind the scenes and let it quietly pass, but actually stand shoulder to shoulder and talk about the work that they've done together to find common ground.
Yeah, one of those areas I thought would have been a good place would, I don't know, paid sick days. Because I do want to get your thoughts on how the administration did handle the rail situation. Because I've been pretty vocally in opposition of what President Biden has done. And I'm a supporter. I think it could have been handled differently, but this could be one of those things like you're talking about.
Yeah, no, look, I think when you look back, a lot of things can always be handled differently as you look in the rearview mirror as opposed to looking forward. And the fact of the matter is, I think that the administration was faced with a very difficult situation. They helped try to negotiate something that they felt like could pass. It did not pass. we're getting into a point, the economy is just beginning to recover. The supply chains, the economics are there. People are working. The economy with a rail strike would have been disastrous. And I think that we're between a rock and a hard place.
No, everyone agrees on that. And yeah. I completely agree and with that.
But I think the messaging could have been better, for sure. I'm always one that thinks messaging could have been better. Even my own messaging that I did in the campaigns, I think, could have been better. But the fact...
If you're talking...
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy. So we show them how. And we tell them with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription. And never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
So talk, they hear you. You can do it if you try.
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248 DE broadcast.